ॐ पार्थाय प्रतिपौलिकां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृतिकां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धृतामि भगवद्गीते भगवद्वेषिणी.
Yam labdhva chaparam labham manyate natikam tataha
manyate natikam tataha
yasmin stito na dukkhena
guru napi vichalyate
yam labdhva cha aparam labham manyate na adhikam tataha yasmin stitaha na dukkena guruna api vichalyate. He says, yam labdhva, having gained which, yam atmanam, having gained which self, labdhva is an indeclinable past participle, so yam labdhva, having gained which, cha, and having gained which, is continuing from the last verse, and having gained which, aparam labham manyate, aparam labham, another gain, labham means to something that you gain, a gain. So having gained which another gain manyate, he na manyate, he does not consider as being adhikam tataha, greater than that. Having gained which, there is no other gain which is greater than that, in his opinion, right? In the opinion of the jnani. So having gained the self, there is no gain which is more than that, which is greater than that. So adhikam means more than, greater, tataha, from that, literally. So greater than that is how we say that in Sanskrit. So he doesn't see, or she doesn't see any that there is any gain of any kind that is greater than that. Yasmin stittaha, and yasmin stittaha, abiding. Stittaha means abiding. Yasmin, in which self, in which. So yasmin stittaha, abiding in which. Na dukena guruna api vichalyate. He or she is not shaken. Is not shaken off course. Is not shaken away from the self by dukkha, by a dukkha, by a sorrow, or a sorrowful situation. Guruna api. Guru means not only guru. We think of guru as our teacher, but guru also means heavy. As opposed to laghu, which means light. So guru means very heavy in weight. Laghu means very light. So it's different, totally different use of the word than from one's guru. So here, by a sorrow, even if it is severe, even if it is a very, very heavy, daunting sorrow, that person is not shaken, is not agitated, or not taken, the idea is not taken away from oneself. So here, going back to the previous verse where it says in the last quarter, this person, stittaha chalati, who's abiding in the self, who knows the self, abiding in the self because of knowledge, right, is never taken away, is never shaken off from that truth, right? So you have to think about it like this. When we say, as a jnani, I'm abiding in the self, what does it mean? Because I'm always, there is nothing else but the self. So there's no distance between your mind and the self. The mind for jnani or ajnani is only abiding in the self. In fact, for that mind, the very swarupa, the very nature of the mind is the atma. So there is no distance for the jnani or the ajnani between the mind and its truth, the atma. There's no separation, there's no distance. It's just like the clay pot. There's no separation, there's no difference between the distance between the pot and the clay. The pot is the clay. So like that for the jnani or ajnani, the truth of the mind, its very self, is the atma. So what does it mean to say that the jnani abides in the atma? It's an abiding in terms of jnana, in terms of recognition, in terms of knowledge, where the viveka is there. That means my mind has recognized my own swarupa, right? I've recognized the swarupa by my own nature as satchit ananda. I've recognized the changelessness of my being, the ananda of my being. The ananda of my being means the natural wholeness and fullness of my being. When we say ananda, we mean that wholeness and fullness that's the beloved nature of my being. Not ananda as some sort of a bliss experience that comes and goes, but the very nature of the I. When I say I am, and in contemplation, especially Nididhyasana is so good for this, where I recognize what is my nature. You can say different things like, I am changeless, I am quiet, I am pure being, I am consciousness. But what about I am beloved, or I am whole, or I am complete? These words are as much lakshanas. They're words that, when I say these words, they're lakshanas, means they're pointing. They're words that are pointing to your own nature. When I say that we make this in this distinction between the shakti, the power of a word. The power of a word can be for the vachyarta, where the word is pointing to something that you already know, right? Something that's well understood in the world. And so when we're using words to describe the atma, the self, we are using words that are known in a particular way in their immediate meaning of the word. Like, for instance, the immediate meaning, the vacharta, that means the immediate meaning, the well-known, well-understood meaning of the word love, for instance. We know that word in terms of the experience of love, of loving, of being loved. We know it as something which is variegated. There's different forms of love, different levels of love. There's loving and loving even more and being overwhelmed by love. We have, you know, all of these varieties of the of love type experiences. And we have, when we think of love, we also think of the absence of love and of hate and hurt, you know, kind of the other side of the spectrum. So it's like if I say hot, probably cold, the word cold will come. And you can talk about different qualities of hot. It could be hot or really hot or warm or lukewarm. You know, so hot has this whole variety of words that we can use to describe it. Well, any word is like that in the world. You know, it's going to be, it's going to have its opposite, and it's going to be temporary experience by nature. You know, and so this is going to be true for all words. Even if we use a word like infinite, it's going to be infinite in terms of quantity, or infinite in terms of space. You know, or infinite in terms of quality. This is what the word will bring to us. And so when we use these words in pointing, in describing the Atma, they have to be words that are used as pointers. And as we use these words, we have to strip off of them, by the use of other words, these limiting factors that the immediate meaning of the word is going to have. So when we use the word ananda in reference to the self, or we use the word love, or wholeness in reference to the self, we have to use other words, other indicators that take words that will point to it, that take off these limitations, you know, like a love that can change into hate, or a love that can go away, or a love that can increase. Like now I'm feeling a little bit of love, but if I meditate more, I can feel more love, you know. Or now I'm feeling a little bit of shanti, but if I meditate more, I can feel more shanti. When we're talking like this, we're talking about vacharta. We're talking about experiences in the mind that change, that modify, that come and go. But when we say that the Atma, the self, is ananda, then we cannot be using the vacharta, the immediate meaning of the word that's known within duality. We now have to use the word love as a word that is going to point to the nature of the self, which is changeless, but whose very swarupa, whose very nature, you can recognize as being deserving the word love. By its own nature, it deserves the word love. But along with this word love comes a lot of other words. That which cannot be objectified. Right? That which is not bound by time, not subject to past, present, or future. Completely changeless. Now, if I say the very nature of the word I, we say that swarupa, that nature, is love. Right? Then you have to, in your mind, you have to say, why now? Say you're contemplating, or right now you're recognizing yourself. Why is the word love or ananda used to point to my being? Because it has to be pointing, a word that is pointing to my being that is present right now. The word love is pointing to my being that is present right now, experienced right now. No matter what the vritti, what type of mood or emotion that your mind is enjoying, you know, what type of, say your mind is agitated or is angry or whatnot. It's not, we're not talking about a state of mind. We're talking about the nature of the me, of this I, that is present to that state of mind. And the ananda that the word ananda is pointing to as your own nature is immediately, aparoksha, experientially present, not covered in any way. Now, that's not true for vrittis, right? You can have an agitated vritti that can become quiet and then become like a blissful vritti, thought modification, and then go away. You can have a mind that's filled with hate and you work on your mind and all of this, and all of a sudden the mind becomes loving. Right? But then that loving, if it could become loving, then it can become not loving also. Mm-hmm. It can become hateful, it can become not hateful. Subject to change, that's the nature of the mind. Your being is not subject to change. And it is the very truth, the very being, it's pervasive, to all of the thoughts that you have, all of the emotions that you have. And it is that is what is the ananda. So now it's your task is to recognize, why do they say I'm ananda? What's ananda about me right now? Where's the ananda right now? And now you can't, if you say that, if I'm challenging you in that way, then you can't say, well, I'm not feeling any bliss right now. Because then if here we have the word bliss. Right here we have the word bliss, and now we're looking for an experience of bliss or happiness or love versus an experience of hate or dislike or the opposite, right? So now we're looking at for a mental experience. I'm not talking about a mental experience. So I'm talking about an emotion that comes and goes. I'm talking about the swarupa, the I, the very nature of I. That is ananda. And when that is the beloved, and that is present to whatever mental emotional state is there. So once that is differentiated, Then the mind, that, and another little thing here, that ananda, that simple ananda that is stable and always there, is evoked in the mind by the inner friend. Like when we say your mind is, and of course then that mind identifies with it, but let me just kind of explain because I think it's helpful to understand this. Based on the meditation that we were doing, you know, when say the mind is hurt or, and you want to have some empathy or soothe the mind to help it to release the hurt, if you evoke what I often call the inner friend, the state of mind that the inner friend enjoys just by being a friend, you know, because once you evoke the inner friend, you've differentiated from the pain. And because you've said friend, that friend has a nature which is a caring nature, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Right? And so the state of mind that is natural to the inner friend that is evoked in that situation mirrors very easily just your own swarupa, your own nature. Because it's doing nothing except being a friend. So just a very simple type of vritti. It's simply being a friend. That vritti is not looking out for anything about itself. It's only caring. That's all it does. So it's a very, very, very simple vritti. See what I mean? And so that vritti is just, it's a meditative vritti in a way. It's a shanta vritti. And so it is very similar in its nature to your own being. In fact, your own being, in a sense, fills that inner friend vritti without any type of obstruction in the vritti. And so it's just a way of getting close to yourself, a vritti which is close to yourself in terms of its own affect. It's like, what I mean, close to yourself. If I have a clean mirror, a clean, shiny mirror, and I hold that mirror up to the sun, right, then the sun reflected in the mirror is close in affect to the actual sun. See what I mean? Because what if it's a muddy mirror? If I hold the muddy mirror up to the sun, right, the muddy mirror, the reflection, if there is any, in the mud-covered mirror, is not going to be very close to the very swarupa of the sun. Or if it's a dusty mirror. They use this example in the Bhagavad Gita. If it's a dusty mirror, it's not going to be very, the reflection of the sun is not going to be very close to it. Because it has its own problems. The mirror's got its own issues, right? But what if when you evoke the inner friend to hold, to have empathy toward the problem in your mind, that vritti, the inner friend vritti, doesn't have issues. It's not dusty. It's not muddy. It's just simple. It's just simply caring, that's all. And so it's what it is reflecting in its own nature is very close to just your own being. And so, in fact, it's nice when you invoke the inner friend to, from that position of the inner friend, to just notice your own swarupa. Because the mind, because the inner friend is also illumined. So from the standpoint of the inner friend, there's a closeness between your own swarupa and the nature of the inner friend. So if you're still with me, we're going to go one other step here. And that is, because this is true, there comes a time when you don't really need the inner friend. The reason is that the inner friend is yourself, has for itself yourself. And so sometimes we evoke the inner friend when the mind, we evoke, because we're dividing up the mind in a way to separate the pain in the mind, to differentiate the pain in the mind from a friend to the, from, you know, to bring a friend in. which has a different relationship with a friend. Vritti is very sattvic, very clean, very clear, you know. Well, there comes a time when that inner friend is just always recognized as your own swarupa, as yourself. You don't need, in a sense, the inner friend, because you are the inner friend, the Atma, the Ananda, the Beloved. Once you recognize it, that is the inner friend that is always the very content of every vritti that you ever have. But if the mind becomes hurt for any reason, or is working through a complex, or something in the world has happened to bring a lot of pain or agitation, then on the level that that agitation is happening, okay, like for instance, something happens in the world that triggers a hurt in you. So say there's an inner child that is now hurt, right? At that time, it is useful to split off the inner friend, to hold the child, to be with the child, to have empathy toward the child, because you're dealing with the child on the same level as the child. Mm. See what I mean? Mm. It's like, if I have a child here in the world, and the child is hurt, then I, as the adult, need to help the child. I'm on the same level as the child. We're in the same order of reality, and I can hold the child. Mm. Right? And so if there's a child inside that's been hurt, or somebody that you can tell, there's a part of you that needs some soothing, you know,
yeah,
then you can provide that soothing in the form of an inner friend, right? To meet that child on its same level. And then that will resolve, that tension will resolve. And then also, the form of the inner friend kind of resolves also into the self. It is the self anyway. Its swarupa is the self. So I'm just trying to show you some certain dynamics, inner dynamics to watch for, to understand, you know, to start to recognize.
Mm.
Right? Because the... In fact, the Ananda that you are is always there present to all of the vrittis, all of the emotions. That inner friend in the very, as the very swarupa of yourself is always there. So when that's the normal state of things. If your mind gets thrown off in any way, you know, then to the complex that is there in the mind, you can bring the complex of the inner friend. Right? The complex that is there in the mind, you meet it with the inner friend with some empathy. Then what happens because of empathy? Remember, you have knowledge. Okay? Because of the empathy, that hurt part in the mind relaxes. As the hurt part of the mind relaxes, the mind is filled with the ananda of the self. And then the problem is no longer there. The problem is there as an objective problem, but not a problem that is overwhelming you. And so, when we say, yasmin stitaha, abiding in that, that person is never shaken off, right? Even by a sorrow that is very great. I was trying to show you a couple of levels as to why that's true. First of all, no matter what is going on in the mind, you're itself. And so that's aparoksha. But even when the mind is in suffering, yourself is never gone. Yourself is always there as the very self that's illumining the inner friend. But you have that technique of evoking the inner friend to help the part that's hurt. You know? If you don't need to do that, if that's not necessary for you to do, because the swarupa of the self is aparoksha, it's not being covered by the hurt, you don't feel like it's taking you away, then there isn't really a problem. There's dukkha because there's dukkha in the world, but that dukkha is being held by your ananda, by your own being. That dukkha is filled with your own being, and so then it's just an experience like all of the other experiences. And they're good experiences and they're bad experiences in terms of sukha and dukkha. That's the nature of the creation. If those experiences are not taking you, as though taking you away, then that's no problem. That's jnana nishtha. It's an experience. It has no capacity to as though take yourself away. If the pain is something that is hurting you, like a complex, the pain is hurting you, then you have that device of bringing the inner friend to give empathy to the part that is hurting. And that empathy relaxes the part that is hurting to put it back into a condition where yourself is bigger than the ananda of yourself is much bigger than the pain. That's what I'm trying to say. For a jnani, what they're talking here about, a jivan mukta, a person who has nishta, right? The atma is not something that can be covered by pain, by dukkha, even if it's a great dukkha. It doesn't have a capacity to, it doesn't compete. It can't compete with your own being. And wherever that pain is, whatever the vritti is, you're itself. And that can't be changed. Yourself doesn't change, and the fact that you are the self of whatever experience is there, that also can't be changed. Right? But if the pain as though takes your mind away, then by evoking the inner friend, right, your inner friend has the self for itself, and that inner friend, you know, can give empathy to the mind. That's what I'm trying to say. We've worked on this in many different ways, so I hope it's not confusing to you. So let's do the next verse.
Tam vidya dukkha samyoga. Tam vidya dukkha samyoga. Vyogam yoga samyutam. Vyogam yoga samyutam. Sanishchayena yoktavyaha. Sanishchayena yoktavyaha. Yogo yogo nirvinna chetasa. Yogo nirvinna chetasa.
Tam vidyat dukkha samyoga vyogam. Actually, this is famous. Tam vidyat dukkha samyoga vyogam. Yoga samyutam. Definition of yoga that Swamiji quotes all of the time. Sa nischayena yoktavyaha yogaha nirvinna chetasa. Having understood this first, these two verses, and it go together. They don't go together in my book, but Swamiji puts them together. It says, vidya, one should know that, which we've just talked about in this previous verses, but the previous 22 in particular, having known which, that person doesn't see any other gain as comparable to it. There is no gain greater than that, because the Atma is the ananda. It is the source of ananda. There is no other ananda, so there's nothing to compare to it. So the one who's abiding in that, for that person, there is no wavering because of a dukkha, because of a sorrow, even no matter how great. So he says, one should know that, what? Dukkha samyoga viyogam. One should know that as yoga. What? This definition. Dukkha samyoga. The association with sorrow means dukkha, samyoga. That association with sorrow, viyoga. One's separation from the association with sorrow. that yoga samyutam, that should be defined or understood. The samyutam is termed. That is termed yoga. So, dukkha samyoga, viyoga, the dissociation from the association with sorrow. Right? Because you are not the sorrow, never at any time. You are the ananda that is present, the ananda that can be present to the sorrow. But your association, who you are, your attachment, your adhyasa, the adhyasa with the sorrow, is not there. There's no I am the sorrow. You know, I am sorrowful. There's the sorrowful, there's the sorrow there. But either as inner friend, you are the friend comforting the sorrow, you know, or you are the ananda which is present to the sorrow. And because you are the ananda which is present to the sorrow is held and comforted. See what I mean? This is what I'm trying to make clear here. You can evoke the inner friend, and the inner friend comforts and has empathy to the sorrow. Or you are, your swarupa is the truth of the inner friend, and you are that, and then you by your nature holds and is comforting to the sorrow. You by your nature holds and is comforting by your swarupa, not by an act of comforting. Like I can say to you, I can do an act of comforting by saying, you know, I love you, I care for you, I understand. That's comforting. Those words are comforting. You know, that's an act of comforting. But the swarupa, the nature behind that act of comforting, is the Atma. Say like this. Say we evoke the inner friend, and the inner friend says, you know, I understand, I understand why you're hurting. But the one who is talking, the swarupa of the one who is talking, is the Atma, which is Ananda. Okay? Now imagine a so-called inner friend who's not really an inner friend saying the same words. Now I understand, I know why you're hurting, blah, blah, blah. There's no swarupa there. There's no ananda swarupa. It's like a bad therapist. bad therapist is, yeah. Poor patient is going on and on, and the therapist is.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing. Yeah. Nobody home. Nobody there.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I'm saying is the words, if they're filled with the ananda of the self, those words are comforting, okay? Even without the words, the presence of the self is comforting. With words or without words? Because what is comforting is the ananda. You know, the love itself is comforting. You're in the presence of somebody who loves you, who cares about you, who is that, whether they say, I love you, I care about you, or they don't, the reality of it is there, and that is comforting. Okay? So, when yourself is present to whatever the vritti is, that is comforting. Okay? When the self as though is not present, even though the self is always present. Let me explain. If the self is as though not present to the hurt part of you, then the hurt part becomes more hurt. Now, how is it that the self, which is always present, could not be present? Okay, as though. It's because instead of an inner friend being evoked, there is an inner enemy that is evoked. Yeah. The critic, the enemy, the hurtful one. And so now what happens there is even though, in fact, the same ananda self is still illumining the vritti is being held by another vritti. Mm-hmm. which is not the inner friend, but is the inner critic, or the inner accuser, or the inner, you know, whatever, the mean one. It's being held by the meanie, by the ogre. And so that is a double whammy. See what I mean? And so then the hurt part is more hurt by this ego identification with another part of the mind that is hostile. And so that's why we say, because usually when there's a hurt part of you, a wounded part of you, there is also a wounder. In other words, when you were a child, for instance, and say, you know, you had a difficult parent, then what happens is the child is hurt by the parent. Okay, that's two. There's the wounder and the wounded. And so what happens in your psyche with complexes, the wounded child keeps getting triggered by the world, right? And then, but when the wounded child is triggered, often what comes along with it is the critical voice of the wounder, right? And so the wounded child now is held by the wounding person, the wounding part. The wounder is holding the wounded child. And so now what has to happen is, instead of the wounder holding the wounded child, you need a voice who is the inner friend that can then hold the wounded child and even the wounder, you know, that's interjected.
Yeah.
And that's how you get out of this mess of being, of always being held, the wounded part being held by someone that is equally wounding. That's why the evoking the inner friend is important, because it breaks through the dyad of the wounder wounding by evoking the inner friend, which has for its own swarupa kindness. It has the self as its nature, because it's an inner friend. And then that inner friend can talk to the wounder and the wounded parts. And that inner friend is close to the self. So you've broken through this dyad. Okay. Then once that happens, you know, then you have an ego, an observing ego, the closest part, the one that you're most identified with an inner friend instead of identified with a critical voice. And that means then that that mind will now enjoy a shanti. That's like a mature mind. It's like the mind of a swami. You know, it's a mind of a saintly person, a mind of a kind person, anytime that you evoke the inner friend. And so then that mind becomes the one who is holding, who is present to the world and present to the complexes, internally and out externally. And then with that inner friend, these complexes can start to settle down, and also the way that you relate to the world starts to change. Right? Because you have more identification with the inner friend than with the wounding parts. And then you start getting used to the swarupa of the inner friend, which is available to you, because the mind, the inner friend part of the mind, is not being tormented with pain. It will hold the pain. It's not being tormented with pain. Right? And so then you have much more opportunity to recognize the constancy of your own being. And then when you're in that situation, then the mind slowly works through in its own time, you know, all of this pain. That takes place, it takes place over time. It depends on what happened to us when we were little. You know, what did we have to hold when we were growing up? You know, what did we have to hold? What happened to us when we were with our parents? What happened to us when we were in school? What happened to us with our peers and with our friends and with our brothers and sisters and all of this? What did that, what, You know, that's the that's what we have to now becomes the kind of the prima materia that we have to work with for the whole rest of our life. I mean, Carl Jung said that what happens to you in the first 3 years you work out for the rest of your life. You know? Yes. You untangle it in this way or that way, you have to work on it, you know. You untangle it. But now this is, he was an Ajnani. He didn't have the self. He didn't have the self to differentiate. So all he had to work with was his mind and the introjects. And a lot of what we're telling you about, inner friend and all of this, is not very far from Jung. It's just we take it all the way to the self, you know, to understand how that all works. So here,
Jung did.
He wasn't Ajnani. So here, when we go back to this now, dukkha samyoga viyoga, the separation of your association with dukkha. So I just told you a whole series of what that kind of separation means. And in the end, it just means the freedom of yourself, because aparoksha, and you recognize yourself as you're not associated with anything. There's a complete, you know, viyoga from any type of dukkha, because it isn't you. But also, you know, when you start working on the antakarana shuddhi, the karma yoga, buddhi, and all of this, that's removing a lot of the dukkha that we have to deal with in the mind because of our attitudes and because of our complexes and all of that. So there's, that inner friend is really helpful for that. Mm-hmm. So he says here in the second line, he says, sanischyena yogtavya. This yoga, this dukkha samyoga viyoga, this is something that's got to be yogtavya. This has to be practiced. It's got to be pursued. Nischyena, you know, relentlessly, with commitment. with commitment. Nischyena means this is your commitment, is to... And we can say commitment. If you're a mamuksha, if you're gaining knowledge, there is no other commitment. Knowledge is your commitment. Knowledge involves caring for the mind. You know, the mind is the one that has to have knowledge. It's the one that has to integrate this knowledge with all of its problems. Just like you have to integrate your knowledge with the whole world of experience, you have to see in terms of your knowledge, in terms of yourself as Ishwara, you have to integrate your knowledge into all of your experiences in the world. Well, you have to integrate your knowledge into all of your inner experiences also. To all of the hurts, to all of the complexes, you have to understand how that works, what it is, you know, how to bring your knowledge effectively to your complexes, to bring your knowledge effectively to all of the hurts and pains and irritations and just the way we are with ourselves, how to bring your knowledge to that in a way that is helpful. So that's all part of knowledge. Self-knowledge doesn't leave anything out. That's why this Bhagavad Gita, there's so much psychology in the Bhagavad Gita. Because we want nishta. Mm. Means that for you to have this knowledge means that you see, you know, I am the whole. This is Ishwara. Even whatever's going on in my mind is Ishwara. You know, but to have that, see that I have, that this pain that my mind is experiencing is Ishwara. If I can say that, I have objectivity. I'm Atma then. If I can say this pain or this hurt or this complex is Ishwara, then I have a certain distance. You know? That means that there's a buddhi there. There's a jnani there. That is being able to handle all of this. Or if my mind is hurting, then like I would help somebody out here who is hurting. If my mind's hurting, then I'll help my mind. That means that there's jnana, there's knowledge there, as opposed to being swept away. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that not being able to be swept away is this dukkha samyoga viyoga. There's a viyoga from this attachment. You know, this association with the dukkha. I don't take myself to be the dukkha. If I don't take myself to be the dukkha, then I can help the dukkha. Mm-hmm. If I don't take myself to be the sorrow, I can help the sorrow. So, I can soothe the sorrow. I can bring knowledge to the sorrow. I can comfort the sorrow. I can bring empathy. Empathy is understanding the person's situation from their viewpoint. That's what, you know. Mm-hmm. Being able to put yourself in the other person's shoes. That's what empathy is. Like if part of you is really hurt and raging and furious and upset, you know, maybe from your standpoint, you're not feeling that way, but that person is. So to be empathy means you can go into the perspective of the person to see, you know, why they are so upset. And that's what Swamiji talks about in a lot of these meditations, you know, where you objectify the one who's really hurting inside of you. You objectify that person and see that person, that part of you, in relationship to the entire situation that you find yourself in. So that you can understand that you're upset because of this happened, because this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this person did this, and this person did this, and that person did that because of this, and that, and this. And this upset is what has been produced by all of that. You know? So then you understand. And you can, then you don't say, you know, how stupid of you to be upset. You say, yes, this is, you are upset, and this is what happened, and this is why you're upset. You know? And it makes sense that this, that you would be upset, you know, because of the way you interpreted the situation and what your needs were at the time. This, you know, this is why you feel this way. You know? And then that's empathy, that you understand. And then once that understanding is there, then you can help. You can help the person, that part of you, get out of it. But you can't help the person get out of it if you don't even understand why they're upset. It's totally useless. Just think of you ever trying to talk with somebody and they just don't understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. You're hurt, you have a problem, something's really upsetting to you, and you're trying to talk to somebody, you know, for some wisdom, but also some comfort. So you're talking to them and they don't have a clue. They might have all kinds of clues, but they don't have that particular clue which would allow them to understand why you are feeling this way. Mm-hmm. See what I mean? And then if they can't do that, then whatever else they say doesn't help very much. Just how it is. So this is true for the way you are toward yourself. If you can't understand why you are hurt or why you're upset, if you can't have that empathy to see, to legitimize it in a sense, not that you don't want to transform it or change it, but at least legitimize it means where you understand why. You understand what went into producing this hurt, you know? Then that part of you will feel seen and held and protected, and then be in a position to be able to change. But until that takes place, often that part you can't beat it out of them. You know, they're not wanting to change because what they need right now is empathy. They need love and care, just like my Tibby, huh?
She always knows when the class is over.
Yeah, it's like it's been long enough, Nest. But you see, I mean, this is. Now, what they say here in this last part, Nirvinna Chaita Sankha, this has got to be understood and practiced without getting discouraged. Nirvinna, don't, your mind should, this is not something to get discouraged about. This is something to own up. Swamiji has a beautiful example in this. He says, you know, gaining this kind of nishta, it isn't like having to carry a big boulder, something like this, he says. It's not like having to carry a big boulder. Rather, it's like dropping a rock. You know, it's instead of care, it's not about carrying something, it's about letting things go. Being able to let things go. And that's why in a sense, this isn't something that is something to get discouraged about. It's actually, it's something to feel relieved about. You know? So, anyway, he wrote in these two verses and the two verses that follow, a long, long commentary on this that is a very beautiful. So you remember, you know, Swamiji said that for him, his commentary on this Bhagavad Gita, along with the Vishnu Sahasranama, he feels that those two things he said, what he needs to say. And as I read, I always read everything that he says in this Gita before I teach it. And I think, boy, it's really good. It's really, really, it's amazing, it's amazing.
He's done a commentary on the Vishnu Sahasranama.
Yeah, but it's a very beautiful too. But this is extraordinary what he's done with this. Okay, let's stop there.
So he's the recording engineer.
Right. Yes, you were correct. You were correct. Yes, good girl. Good girl.
Om Purnamidam Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
You said something that I was thinking about today. It doesn't have to do with inner friend, but like today I had this squirt of anger, you know, and just this little squish of rage came out and then it went away. But I was looking at that thinking, well, that doesn't have anything to do with me. That's Ishwara's, is that Ishwara's game or what's happened there?
Well, it doesn't have anything to do with you in terms of the self. So if you recognize, it's nice to be able to recognize that you really are not changing when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
You want to say that it's Ishwara. There's nothing in Maya that isn't an Ishwara. But when you say that this is Ishwara, then when you say that, it's good then to objectify. When you say it's Ishwara, then you have to objectify your body and your mind, your sense organs, the people around you, the whole situation that has given rise to that squirt of anger. That whole, all of the laws, everything that's involved in the production of that anger is Ishwara. So you have to put the whole jiva in there. To see, when you see it as Ishwara, the whole jiva, everything about you, and the whole context, and all the laws involved that has caused that. You know, then you say, it's Ishwara. See what I mean? The whole jiva then has to be given over to, and that's actually helpful to do that. That's kind of just a different way of doing what I'm kind of talking about.
Yeah. I felt relieved when I thought that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I also didn't feel like Ishwara was, it was like remote control and he was... This deity was playing out life through me. I didn't feel that either, you know.
Yeah.
So when you said that, that the ananda of the self is always present.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I guess obviously it's not clear to me. I mean, that's why I'm sitting in class and
Well, but, part of the way reason it's not clear, though, I think, for people, is because the definition of ananda, you know, is bliss. You know, and so when you think of ananda as bliss, then you, I'm not having any bliss right now, you know. And so now, so it becomes a matter of recognizing your the constancy of your own being, and then you ask yourself, why would this be called ananda? Why would the I, the sense of me, be referred to as ananda? Go ahead, I cut you off.
So, I mean, but one thing that sort of was quite clear was this inner friend. I mean, this seems like something that I could bring, I mean, not that I can, but it's sort of clear that I can bring it out whenever I want.
Yes.
And that inner friend would be a sort of calm person. So is that sort of, I mean, when you say that, like sort of the Shanti of Karma Yoga is a relative version of the absolute. So is this sort of a relative version of the absolute constancy of the self?
It is, in a sense. Well, I would say like this: the inner friend is simple. You know, it's like the still water reflecting the sun. You know, and so there's a relationship between the reflection of the sun and the sun, in a sense. And so when the inner friend is there, the mind, that vritti, is a shantavritti, right? And so that shantavritti, by its nature, is not really competing with your own swarupa, with your own nature. And so say from the standpoint of the inner friend or the shantavritti, then you just look at the me, the awareness, the your own sense of self. Just like if you're meditating, you make your mind very quiet. And then you ask yourself, what is the nature of me, the one that is present to this mind? Then it's much more obvious, right? Because there's not a lot going on in the mind. There's not a lot of agitation or pain or competing types of emotions. So then you can recognize that. So now when you have the inner friend, there again, shantavritti, and the very nature of the one that's illumining the mind is not going to be in competition. The mind isn't in competition in terms of affect with the one who's illumining. So then you say, what is the nature of this one, this me?
You mean the inner friend at that point?
Yeah. And just look at the me, the self of the inner friend. You'll see that it's very, I can use words, but all the words have to point. Very, very strong, very simple, very non-judgmental, you know, whole, complete. There's nothing that it needs, you know. It is full unto itself. So these are just words, point, point, point. Okay. So see if those kind of words, those are the words that are equivalent to ananda. You know, it is whole, complete, very strong in the sense that nothing can shake it or change it. The non-judgmental, unassuming nature. That's all the words pointing to the Atman. And so you just recognize, like right now, if you just recognize can you just slow down your mind for a minute and just recognize your own presence? All of these words are pointing to that presence. You know, and what happens is you start to recognize that simple presence of yourself is always there. Usually we're so caught up in the mind with its emotions and in chit, you know, talking back and forth to itself. We don't recognize this silent, strong, whole, complete presence that illumines the whole thing. So that differentiation has to be, and then pretty soon, at some point your ahankara goes from the mind, identification with the mind, to the self. So the ahankara now is labeling, the I labels me, that constant self, not the different thoughts in the mind, or the different conditions in the mind. So then that's nishta, that differentiation is just natural. And it takes a while to get that because the mind is so used to only taking itself to be the conscious me. And therefore, it's always equating its own emotions and feelings with me. That's what it's done forever.
So,
Yes, he's found it.
So I got a question. You were saying at some point, if the self is not present, right, then the hurt becomes more hurt.
But what did I mean? The self is always present, right? But I was talking about if you bring, what causes that to seem that way, the self is not present. Because instead of evoking an inner friend that's holding it, you're evoking the perpetrator,
right,
the wounder.
Right, and the piece I was missing in this process that you described was, you said something like the same Ananda is illuminating. Now, what is this, that same Ananda illuminating now, actually?
Oh,
because
when
that's
I was going
I
through
kind
that?
Of lose it,
oh, know? Okay.
Because it fits
already.
Like,
the self, mm-hmm. which is Ananda, mm-hmm. not bliss, but the wholeness of the self, illumines the vritti, period, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the vritti is to be illumined
okay.
by that.
Okay.
Now, say we divide the vritti, which the mind is always doing that,
mm-hmm.
and now we have the hurt mind, and then we have the one who's related to the hurt mind. That can be the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
The one, say you were hurt as a child, now that hurt is active in the mind, and so then also is active is the other side of it, or the critical mind that is impatient with the hurt mind. Oh, you're hurt. Why are you always complaining? Blah, 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 blah. That kind of stuff, you know? Okay, so now that perpetrator, I call it, is holding in relationship to itself the hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But the Ananda of the self is illumining both the hurt mind and the perpetrator. There is no other self, really, that's illumining the Ananda. But the thing is, the perpetrator is painful, and the hurt is painful, and so pain is holding pain. There. Both of which are illumined by the Atma. So now, when you kind of understand this kind of convoluted dynamics that go on,
yeah.
if you can evoke the inner friend, right, now the inner friend, this ego, is relating itself to the hurt part
mm-hmm.
and can relate to the perpetrator also.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because the perpetrator is as much an introject as the... When you're a child, you introject the painful, the little child that is really hurting, but you don't introject the little child by herself or himself. You introject the dyad, the pain, the hurt child, and the one who hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So you're carrying both of those inside.
Mm-hmm.
And so now in the process of neutralizing or healing the little child, you also have to heal the perpetrator. Because the perpetrator is not somebody out there anymore. It's somebody that has been introjected in your own psyche. And so actually, the little child is an image of the hurt child along with the affect. And the perpetrator is also the little child who is interjected that, you know. I mean, there's no adult inside. This all happened when you were little. So it's the little child's vision of being hurt, the little child's vision of the one who hurt. Both are inside. And so now when you have the inner friend has to be somebody who cares about the dyad and can say to the perpetrator part, "Is you don't have to be that way anymore." Because both are interjected. And to the part that's hurt is, you know, I love you and I care about you, or whatever is appropriate to say, to the empathy.
That's clear. What does interject exactly mean?
Interject is when you're young, especially, when you have an experience that you can't handle because it's
mm-hmm.
too much for you, you as though swallow it whole into the unconscious and
mm-hmm.
then close it off.
mm-hmm.
And it becomes like you know, in, held, it becomes like an experience held in the unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
But the experience will be in kind of a dyad form between, you know, made up of the one who was hurt and the one who did the hurting.
It's very clear.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. And the thing is that if you go in, inside as that inner friend, then it's as though you're going in to rescue the child.
Yeah.
Because the child is inside with no way, just reliving the same feeling, affect, you know, over and over and over again, with no way to get out. The only way that child gets out is by projecting onto the world. Either projects the perpetrator part,
mm-hmm.
or projects the wounded part. And you become the perpetrator, or the world's the perpetrator and you're the wounded. Then you're the perpetrator, the world's the wounded, goes mm-hmm. back and forth like that, because the dyad is keeps projecting out, and you don't have any control over it. You know, the world triggers it, one side of the projection or the other, and then you're just, those emotions are
overwhelmed.
Yeah, overwhelmed the ego. But this, so what happens is you have to, if you can evoke that inner friend, then you can go into be with the child, you know, and comfort it. You bring consciousness to it, and then there's a whole process of change.
What do you say to the critic?
The critic is you. I like to think of the critic as a little boy wearing daddy's shoes.
He doesn't know what he's talking about.
No, it's
yeah.
It's because it's a 3-year-old that interjected
a role model.
The 3-year-old interjected the perpetrator, and so it's a 3-year-old's version of the perpetrator. You know, say if that's your mother, then, you know, it's a little child dressing up like mommy and trying to, because it's interjected, right? It's the little child that is interjecting the hurt, the one who is hurt and the one who's hurting. And so that's why you can talk to the so-called perpetrator as, you know, it's all right. You don't have to do that anymore.
So emotionally, they're the same age, basically.
Yeah, because they're the age of the one who interjected them.
Mm.
But that 3-year-old is interjecting an adult. So what is an adult to a 3-year-old? It's not going to be exactly true to the adult. It's true to the experience of the 3-year-old, right? It's the 3-year-old's adult.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the 3-year-old's child also. And the experiences for a child can be very, very intense and all-consuming.
So what is the
inner friend? Much bigger than life, actually, for a little child.
So what does the inner friend do with this?
The inner friend is the adult that can go, the kind person, you know, like the good parent that can go, you know, and be with the child and understand the pain, because you remember what happened to you when you were little. So you can go as an adult to that little child and say, and understand, say, this is why you're so afraid, but that's not how it is now, and I'm here, and whatever it needs to hear. You know? You can go and understand the situation, why all of that pain and fear is there, and because you know what happened. And then you can be there as somebody who's
But you take it one more step where it resolves into one's own nature.
Yeah, because in the end, yourself is what is aproksha, and the inner friend is natural to your ego. You see what I mean? So the inner friend is just what the ego is. That's the nature of the ego. You don't have to evoke the inner friend. You are the inner friend. And your own swarupa is the very self of the inner friend. So the swarupa, the nature of yourself, is aparoksha, and what is natural to your ego is the inner friend. So you don't need to evoke the inner friend because you are the inner friend from the standpoint of the buddhi. But that's not true initially. Initially, there's other identifications that the ego has because of traumas and because of upbringing, like the ego could be overwhelmed by the critical voice. The ego could be overwhelmed by somebody cruel, you know. And then that's the one that's talking to the to the different parts of you that are hurting. And so therefore you evoke the inner friend in order to neutralize the cruel interjects that are normally holding and keeping hurt, the different hurt parts of the mind. But there comes a time where there is no more cruel voices. They've all been neutralized. So what is your, you are the inner friend. And so whatever is going on in your mind or going on in the world, if that's being related to by the inner friend, which is the nature of your buddhi, the nature of your ego. And that inner friend is a natural to your own nature.
So does your ahankara kind of shift from initially, you know, you're always the hurt person or you're the critic, and then slowly your ahankara shifts to the inner friend because...
It does, absolutely, yeah. Because the inner friend is what's natural to you as a human being.
Yeah.
That's what's natural because it's a natural expression of your own nature.
So that's like the mature person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Radha, what, I'm not clear about the meaning of when you said, I am beloved. I understand that I am the beloved.
Yeah.
But that's away from me, right?
No, the very swarupa of the Atma is the beloved. What is the self that we call Ananda? The Atma itself, its very nature is the beloved.
What
if I say its very nature is Ananda? Like say when Rumi or some of the poets were...
Yeah, that's exactly.
But they're talking about the Atma, their mind's recognition of the Atma. So the Atma becomes the beloved of the mind.
So the I am is the beloved.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the mind is has discovered that the Atma is the beloved.
Okay. So we don't have to create that. That is just inherent.
It's inherent,
and that's the real you.
Oh, Tibby, Tibby's
she's
hunting.
She's a noisy
when
hunter.
When you say the inner friend is the mind, you're really saying
the inner friend, the true
nature of the mind is really the inner friend.
It is, but initially you have to evoke it if you've got a critic in there.
You could also say the enemy. The inner enemy is the mind. You could say that too, because it's all in the same.
Yeah, but when you're saying that, what is an enemy, is not natural to you, because the enemy is something you want to get rid of. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, the enemy or that which hurts. These are things that you want to get rid of. They're not things that you are comfortable with. Just by the word enemy. Mm-hmm. You know?
Well,
enemy needs to be defeated and conquered.
Is it normal or natural to have an inner critic, or is that...
It's natural to samsara.
It is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, some sort of problem's going to be there. Because we don't always get what we want, you know.
So that's universal, then,
in a way. It's universal.
Yeah, okay.
Enemy is a universal word.
Yeah.
It's a... But it's not natural to you.
No.
It's natural to you to ignorance.
Yeah.
But it's not natural to your being.
So if there's ignorance there, you would expect that.
In some form or another.
Yeah.
Okay. Unless you have no desires. It's not possible for an ajnani to not need something to be happy. It's not possible.